Well, as we get started, I just want to give the quick recap so we remember where we're at. So the long story short is Festus had decided to pass the buck, so to speak, and agree to send Paul to Caesar when Paul had appealed to Caesar. But he had a problem, right? He didn't know what to tell Caesar. He's like, this guy has done nothing deserving of death. I'm not sure what I'm going to tell Caesar when I send him up there. So when King Agrippa came to visit, he asked King Agrippa, King Agrippa, it seems absurd to me to send this guy up to Rome to appear in front of Caesar when I have no idea what he supposedly has done that's worthy of death. So Paul gets a chance to make his defense to King Agrippa, and he describes his experience on the Damascus Road. He demonstrates that he was just being obedient to Jesus and sharing him as a light to both the Jews and the Gentiles alike. And once again, King Agrippa comes to the conclusion that Paul has done nothing worthy of death. And matter of fact, he tells Festus a little bit later, says, you know what? Had this guy not appealed to Caesar, we could have just let him go right now. But since he appealed to Caesar he will go. So today we actually see that journey begin as Paul is making his way to Rome. This is probably in October of the year 59 AD. It was a little bit too late in the fall to be on the open seas. And wouldn't you know that things are about to get a little rough on those open seas as they get moving forward. And Paul, he actually understands that there's a real danger coming to be traveling at this time. And he encourages the crew to find safe harbor for the winter. But the owner of the ship decides that he wants to keep pressing on to find a better place to harbor for the winter. And well, if you guys know the story, I imagine most of you guys do. This is Paul's fourth shipwreck, I believe. But despite the problems and opposition that is faced along the way, God's plan is still going to move forward. Amen? Amen. So let's get started. Acts 27, verses 1 through 2, it says, and when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius, and embarking in a ship of Adramidium. Who read that unobtainium? Anybody read that unobtainium? Adramidium, which is about to sail. Yeah, the Amplified Version. Which is about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia. We put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. All right, so now's the time. Paul is finally going to be making his way towards Italy. And it's not the ideal circumstances that we would think that Paul was going to be making his way to Rome. You know, if this was our plan, you know, Paul would have been free. He'd have been riding high. He would have been making his trip to Rome in style. God would have been taking care of him. But that's not the case. Paul's going to make it to Rome just like God said, except for he's doing it as a prisoner. Now, we discussed it last week. Truth is as far as prisoners go, he's got it pretty lax. They're taking care of him. And when you look at it from God's perspective, God's getting him there with a centurion. 100 Roman soldiers are going right there with him. He's being protected from anything that could come his way. So it may not be the way that we would have done it, but God is still in control. God's plan is working, and God is going to get Paul to Rome. Amen? We also see for the first time since chapter 21, Luke says it was decided that we should sail to Italy. This gives us the indication that Luke is on this journey with him as well. Luke's on the boat with Paul. Luke was a physician, it may be that he was just coming to provide care for Paul, to be his personal physician. Maybe he was just coming to support Paul as one of his disciples. But for whatever reason, Luke is now back with Paul, and they're heading up. He's taking this boat ride with him up to Rome. This is also, you know, kind of shows that once again that Paul's got it pretty easy as far as being a prisoner goes, at least at this point in time. He's allowed to have friends. He's allowed to have people visit him. In addition, we're bringing Aristarchus, who's coming along on this journey, who's mentioned here as a Macedonian from Thessalonica. Last time, we saw Aristarchus was in Ephesus, and you'll remember that him and Gaius were seized and dragged into the amphitheater when everyone was getting riled up about Paul in Ephesus. So he's been with Paul for some time as well. Paul's ministered to him. Paul has followed him. And he's actually mentioned quite a few times in the New Testament. He actually becomes one of Paul's traveling companions that we see quite often. He's mentioned as a fellow worker of Paul in Philemon 24. It says, and so do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, my fellow workers. So he's mentioned as a fellow worker there. Paul refers to him in Colossians 4:10. He says, Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you. And Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you have received instruction, if he comes to you, welcome him. So we see Aristarchus once again in Colossians. And it's interesting there because Paul refers to him as his fellow prisoner. But what's interesting as we're discussing this, you might think, oh, well, maybe he's a prisoner here with Paul. But there really is no other indication that he's a prisoner. So as I was studying this, it looks like many theologians think that Paul may have been just referring to like Paul, he was a captive of Christ, my fellow prisoner, my fellow captive of Christ. So continue on in verses 3 through 4. It says, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. So Sidon's about 70 miles north of Caesarea, which is where they just left from. And Julius was that centurion that was put in charge of Paul. And we don't know if Julius was a believer or not. It's not, you know, made clear to us. But we do know that he was actually pretty good to Paul. He took care of Paul. He treated him kindly. And he is actually one of several centurions in the New Testament that is shown in a positive light. It turns out that many of these guys were just good guys. And he's also the one that, as we get further in the story, when the ship is going down and everyone else, all the other soldiers are like, we got to kill all the prisoners lest they escape. It's actually Julius that protects Paul and ensures that he is not killed. So when they arrive, he goes ahead and when they land, he lets Paul go and see his friends in the area. And the Christians in this area are probably a result of the believers when they were first driven from Jerusalem, the dispersion, when the Christians were pushed away from Jerusalem due to persecution. These churches were started, and that's probably where these Christians that he's going to go visit, these friends, come from. And they provided for Paul. They probably provided food and supplies to make sure that he had enough on his journey. And even though Paul was a prisoner, just like when he was with Festus, he was actually treated pretty well. He was given a lot of leeway. I mean, can you imagine nowadays, like somebody's in prison, they're like, yeah, just this, the boat's leaving in a couple hours, just make sure you're back on time. See, the reality is nobody thought Paul had done anything that was deserving of death. It's almost like they were just going through the motions. So anyway, when it's time to go, the most direct route to Myra, which we'll see in the next verse is where they're heading, the most direct route would have taken them southwest of Cyprus. This would have essentially been the same route that Paul had taken on his third missionary journey when he was traveling in that area. But due to the time of their travel, they had to make some changes. Because the winds at this time of the year, we're in October, we're getting into the winter months there. Actually, I don't know if it's the winter months there. Is it the winter months in Italy at that time? It's always confusing. Down in the southern hemisphere, everything is switched. So I think we're still in the northern hemisphere. But it's the winter month, so it's not a good time for travel. It's actually quite deadly for them to be traveling, especially the closer they get towards, you know, November and in December. So in order to not go out on the open sea and to be bombarded with these crazy winds, they actually have to stay kind of tucked up in near the coastline, near the shoreline, so that they're able to dodge the wind here. This, it says under the lee of Cyprus. The lee, when you get in between an object and the wind, that area where they blocks the wind, that's the lee. So the lee of Cyprus there is they're dodging this terrible storm by the land blocking The wind's coming through. So as a result, they kind of have to stay between Cyprus and the mainland to stay out of the wind. And that's the direction that they're taking so far. And then verses 5 through 8, it goes on. It says, when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lycia, where the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Haven, near which was the city of Lycia. So finally, the ship makes it to Myra. While there, Julius finds another ship, because now they have to actually go across larger open waters. They probably don't want to take one of the smaller ships. And he finds this large grain ship. And it not only carried grain, but we find out that it's quite a large ship, because in chapter 27, we're going to find out that there was 276 people on board, in addition to all the grain that it's carrying. This is not a small ship. And as they get on it, it seems like their travels as they make out towards Italy is quite difficult here as well. And even though the captain of the ship, he was probably hoping to make it before winter, to Italy before winter, the winds and the weather was already turning. It's already turning against them. And it's getting rough once again. And then once they arrive to Cnidus, it turns out they can't go any farther over open water. The winds are too strong. They're in the wrong direction. So they slip under that lee of Crete. And apparently, when you're sailing this way, it's much slower. It's much more dangerous. You're not over open water where you can go full speed, and when the wind is in your favor, it's a much slower, much more arduous travel. And then once they finally make it to Fair Haven, they really can't go any further, because the way the coastline is shaped, actually, I'll show you. I know this is kind of hard to see, but right here is Crete, and you can see there's this like little lip where it goes up and to the left. And if they were to keep going any further up to Italy, they would no longer have the coast unless they curled back up into the coast of Crete. So they can't really go any farther towards Italy at this point, because it's just going to be too hard to cover the open waters with the weather the way that it is. If they were to continue on, they would be exposed to the full force of these adversarial winds. And then verses 9 through 10, as we continue on, it says, since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo in the ship, but also of our lives. So while they're there at Fair Haven, they have a decision to make. Are they going to continue on to try to make it to Italy, or are they going to try to find a better port to weather for the winter? You know, they have a decision to make. What's going on? Apparently, the port of Fair Haven was not an ideal port to stay for the weather, for the winter. I don't know if it was just too small of a port. I don't know all the details, but they had decided that it's not a good place for them to stay. They wanted to push on somewhere else. And in this time, traveling between mid-September to mid-November was considered dangerous, but it was considered deadly to sail from mid-November to mid-February. They started off in October, so we're getting close to that deadly time to sail. And Paul gives his opinion on the matter. Now, it's not clear to me from the text here if this was from God or just Paul using a little bit of wisdom based on what's known about sailing at this time. It doesn't really seem to indicate that God told him this, but rather it's based on his experience. And in his second letter to the Corinthians, which was written before this, he already tells them that he had been in three shipwrecks. Turns out Paul has some experience in being in a ship when things aren't going well. Can you imagine being in three shipwrecks? You know, it's so easy for some of us to like, why are things going so rough? aren't I doing the right things? Am I doing something wrong? Is God upset with me? God, look what Paul went through. And Paul was doing the right thing. Paul was serving God. Bad circumstances are not necessarily an indication that you are opposing God. I say not necessarily because you need to examine your life. Maybe sometimes they are. Maybe sometimes you're just doing dumb yourself and opposing God yourself. But not necessarily that the how your life is living out, if everything's perfect, everything's great, is not necessarily an indication that it is God is for you or against you. I mean, you can look at Hollywood today, and from a human perspective, they seem to have it all going on. They have money, fame, power, all the stuff that they need, but many of them are not in good shape. We see famous people committing suicide because they hate their life, even though it seems like from the outside looking in, you can go, why is God blessing them? They're not actually being blessed. The Bible says that the blessings of the Lord make rich and add no sorrow to them. But Paul's been shipwrecked 3 times. Good thing he didn't say, man, God must be really against me or I shouldn't be doing this. Can you imagine if Paul's like, all right, 4th shipwreck is too much. I'm done with this. What I think is turns out Paul kind of knew what to expect. He had some experience in some bad ship rides. So he says, listen, guys, I perceive based on the time of year it is, based on the way the weather has been, based on my own personal experience in these situations, that if we leave, it's going to be a bad deal. Not only are we going to lose the cargo, we're going to lose the ship, but we're also going to lose our lives. Use some wisdom, and let's go ahead and stay here for the winter. But as we continue on in 11 through 12, it says, the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow... Now, that seems like already they know it's a bad decision. We're going to head out on the chance we can make it. It says, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So the centurion may have liked Paul, may have been kind to Paul, but he still thought the ship captain would know better of sailing than Paul. So he paid more attention to the captain and to the owner of the ship, which, to be honest, I think is understandable. I think most of us would probably trust who should be the expert. I mean, we're not talking like this is a brand new captain and a bunch of brand new sailors. They have experience in this stuff as well. So I don't think we should be too critical of Julius when we read this, because I think that's our first instinct, right? You idiot, don't you know this is Paul? Why aren't you listening? But I think we shouldn't be too critical. He was listening to the people that do this for a living. In addition, the port where they were at was not a good place to spend the winter. Like I said, I don't know the details of why, but they all agreed that it wasn't. And how many of you know that when you don't want to be somewhere, sometimes we make poor decisions to get out of that situation? So they took the chance that they could make it up to Phoenix. So it seems like a vote was taken, at least among the sailors. I don't know if everybody was included. But they decided to head out, hoping to make it to a better port to spend the winter. The worst part is they're not even trying to make it to Italy. They're just trying to make it a little bit further up the coast to winter in Phoenix instead of there in Fairhaven. So like I said, they decided to creep along the coast, hoping to make a better port, and maybe not a bad plan had it gone according to plan. So if we go back a little bit to that map that I showed you, and I apologize, I know it's a little small, but it's hard to fit everything there. But this little island here, right here, is New Haven, and if they go up along the coast, there's Phoenix right there. But we're about to find out that the winds have other plans for them. So this red mark is actually the course that they probably took, because things are about to get a little bit rough. In verses 13 through 15, it says, now when the south wind blew gently, supposedly that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor, sailed along Crete close to the shore. Now, the funny thing is the wind actually lets up for a little bit. And they see this I guess it would be the calm before the storm, and they think that they're going to make it. So they said, supposing they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. If anybody's reading this and goes, what does that mean, they weighed anchor? It just means they pulled the anchor up. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land, and when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. So at some point, they're there at Fair Haven. The wind lets up just a little bit, and they think it's going to be okay. So the captain and everybody says, all right, let's go, guys. We got good weather. We're going to go ahead and try to make our way to Phoenix, further up the coast of Crete. But it doesn't take long for the wind to change. You know, and I don't know if this was the enemy trying to waylay Paul, or it is the middle of winter, and that's just what happens in winter. You know, sometimes the enemy gets involved, and sometimes we just make poor decisions. You know, if you live in a known area that has earthquakes all the time, and you decide to live there, you can't really get mad when an earthquake happens. You know what's going to happen. You go sailing in this time of year, the weather's probably not going to be good. But then again, I imagine the enemy didn't want Paul to get to where he was going anyway. So the wind picks up, and it's not some small wind. This word here that is translated tempestuous, the Greek word, is actually the word where we get our English word typhoon from. These are hurricane-strength winds, typhoon-strength winds. This is not a small storm that's coming in. And actually, if you other translations, the New Living Translation, for example, actually translates it as a typhoon-strength wind. And unfortunately, ships of this era, they're not really as mobile as the ships that we have today. You know, if this were to come in and the winds were unfavorable, blowing the wrong way, ships today are mobile enough that they can actually alter their course and hit it diagonally and zigzag back and forth and oppose wind that is going against them. But the ships of this day, they're not really that mobile. They don't have that ability. And so when the winds start blowing the wrong way, especially when they're hard like this, the ship just goes where the wind wants it to. And that's kind of what happened here. The ship was at the mercy of these crazy strong winds. And the ship went where the wind blew, regardless of where they were trying to make it to. So then in verse 16 through 17, it says, running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship, and then fearing that they would run aground in Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. So we go back to that map here. This little tiny island right here is where they get behind this island, the lee of this island, and they're able to at least get enough control that they can start putting stuff back together on the ship. So it says they managed with difficulty. And this is about, this island is like 25 miles or so in the opposite direction that they were hoping to travel. And they slipped into its lee, and they took opportunity to secure things. So ships in these days, they usually pulled a lifeboat. It's not usually secured to the ship. They would tow it behind them. And this is the boat, if they were outside of port, they would jump on this smaller boat to get into smaller ports. It could be used as a lifeboat. But it's a pretty important thing to have with the ship. And at this point, it's being dragged behind in the storm for 25 miles. If they left it that way, there's always the potential that they could slam into their ship and damage it, or they could just lose this boat altogether. So when they slip into the lee of this island, they with great difficulty, it says, were able to get it in. Now imagine, it's probably full of water. It's probably unwieldy with all that extra weight, but they're able to get it up. They secure it. And then we have this next sentence. So they used supports to undergird the ship, and then fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and this were driven along. Now, at least for me when I'm reading this, maybe it's because I don't know enough about operating a ship. I don't know what this means. Like, what does it mean to undergird? No, that's actually not what it means. That's what they did. So anyway, the point of this, that I'm sharing this, is sometimes when you don't know what something is saying, one of the tricks you can use to help you study the Bible is that if you're reading something and it's not quite right, you don't quite get what it's saying, look it up in other translations. Now, the English Standard Version is a word-for-word translation. That's what they do their best to do, is to translate it directly as written. But other translations try to make it more modern English for us to understand a little better. And if you look at multiple translations and read them together, it can give you some additional insight. So even here where it says they lowered the gear, like in my head, I'm thinking they've got like their working gear or something, you know? So anyway, you read other ones. New Living Translation says the sailor bound ropes around the hull of the ship to strengthen it. They were afraid of being driven across the sandbars of Sirtis off the African coast, so they lowered the sea anchor to slow the ship and were driven. Oh, so the gear just meant the anchor. Same thing, the New International Version. The men hoisted it aboard. They passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. And then that other part, they lowered the sea anchor. So one of the things you can do to help understand what you're reading, if you don't quite get what it says, is look at other translations. When you see how multiple different translations have translated a sentence, sometimes it can help you understand what's going on here. So now we know. They threw some ropes around the boat, tied it together. Basically, the idea was that when you tied these ropes around and pulled it in, this extra support would help the timber, the actual hull of the ship, stay together when it's being battered by crazy wind and crazy waves. And then the idea with this anchor. So here's the thing. It says they were fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis. So what this is sandbars that are actually off the coast, the northeastern coast of Africa, 400 miles away. How afraid do they have to be to think that this wind is going to take them out of control for over 400 miles? This must have been some storm that they were getting ready to endure. So they drop this anchor, hoping to slow the boat down, the ship down. For all of you guys who are sailors, and I just called a ship a boat, I'm sorry. I know it's a ship. It's like my wife has a 4Runner, and I call it her truck all the time. It drives her crazy. So they drop this anchor, though, hoping to slow them down a little bit, to have them have some control. But even still, they're at the mercy of the wind. And in verse 18 through 20, it says, since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. So despite all the things that they were able to do, the ship is still being beaten up. They still don't have any control. So they begin to start tossing cargo overboard to hope to lighten the ship. I mean, I think the idea is the less weight on the ship, the more buoyant it's going to be, the greater chance that it's going to stay upright. But then even then, that wasn't enough. It says the third day after that, they started throwing the ship's tackle overboard. That just means all the ship's equipment overboard. They're really trying to lighten this ship up. And you have to imagine, for the crew to take these actions, they were genuinely afraid. These were sailors. This wasn't like me and AJ were operating this boat. These guys were sailors. They knew what they were doing. They were afraid. So they just start tossing. And then after many days, which was so, this storm is so intense, they haven't seen the sun or stars for several days. Now, we have GPS. They navigated by the sun and the stars. They probably have no idea where they're at right now. And they're just being torn across. And at this point, it's been many days where there's no sun or stars, and they kind of just give up hope. They're like, look, I think we're past the point of no return. And then in verse 21 through 22, it says, since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." So it seems now that the ship's crew hasn't eaten for several days. And we don't know why. They may have just been too busy trying to guide and secure this ship through this tempest that's been going on for several days. Or maybe they were just too distracted by what was coming up, or they were afraid to eat. Whatever it is, they haven't eaten in a few days. So Paul encourages them, guys, you need to eat and gain your strength. And then he gives them the small, "I told you so," little jab to the kidney there. He says, "Listen, I told you guys that if we took this ship, that it would lead to disaster. But the good news is he encourages them. He encourages them to take heart. He says, "Listen, guys, eat, get your strength, take heart, because there's not going to be any loss of life. We're all going to live. We're going to lose this ship, but we're going to live." And you may wonder, well, how is Paul so sure of this? And in verse 23 through 26, which is where we'll go ahead and end today, he says, "For this very night there stood before me an angel of God, of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.'" The reason Paul was sure is because God told him that they were going to make it. You see, the night before telling them to eat, an angel stood before God, before Paul, and told Paul not to be afraid. And the reason? Because Paul had a purpose that God intended to see fulfilled. Paul had to stand before Caesar and present the gospel in Rome. And what's interesting to me, though, is that how many know for God to fulfill his purpose, all he's got to do is get Paul there, right? But in addition to making sure that Paul is saved and Paul gets there, God is going to save the rest of the ship. And what I find interesting is what it says. It says, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar." Remember, this is the angel of the Lord talking to Paul. He says, "God has granted you all those who sail with you." Isn't that interesting? Paul must have been praying for these guys. Paul wasn't just praying for himself. Paul was praying for every man on this ship. "Lord, let them live. Save us. Let us make it through." And God answered Paul's prayers. And Paul was, even the ones who had, I mean, imagine if you were in this situation. "I told them not to sail. Now we're about, do you think you'd be praying for them?" We should be. Jesus, we should even pray for our enemies. You know, and Paul is setting the example for us. I mean, he probably had a right to be upset, but instead he just prays for them, not just for himself. The ones that ignored his advice, the ones that are wrongfully holding him in captivity, he's praying for them too. And God says, "Listen, it's been granted those who you've been praying for." What an example for us to follow. So with the outcome secure, he encourages them to take heart. Notice how sure Paul is too. He says, "Listen, I have faith that it's going to come about just exactly as I was told." Paul is not like, "Hopefully you guys are going to make it." He's convinced because he has faith in God. You know, today's been a weird one. There's not been a whole lot of theology shared in this passage of Scripture. It's been a lot of just the history of what actually happened, right? They landed here, they left here, they went there, the weather was bad, they didn't listen to Paul, they got in trouble, but God's going to save them anyway. But even in those small things, we can still see that God is moving in this entire situation. God is there to make sure that Paul makes it to Rome. He has an escort. God is there that even when the weather turns against them, God says, "Don't worry, Paul, it's going to be all right." It's like when Jesus was sleeping in the boat and the storm came. And these were fishermen. They're used to, if the storm was big enough to scare these fishermen, it was a big storm. And Jesus is like irritated that they woke him up. You know, where is your faith? But here we have an example of a man who is, from a human perspective, has every reason to be upset, to be jaded, to be irritated, to be upset at God. God, why are you letting this happen to me? How many shipwrecks do I have to endure? But instead, he just continues to trust God, knowing that God is going to do what he says he's going to do. And in addition, he prays for those who were against him, who ignored him, who weren't listening to him. This Paul is the kind of person that we should aim to be like. Matter of fact, that's why he said, imitate me as I imitate Christ. So even in areas where it seems like it's just history, we can still learn so much from those who are going through the situations. So now he says, listen, it's going to be exactly as I said. We're going to lose the ship, but you're going to keep your life. We just have to run aground on some island. Now, I've always thought that was a curious expression. Don't know which island, but some island. And unfortunately, we have to leave you on another cliffhanger this week. This is the last few chapters of Acts is like the just cliffhanger after cliffhanger. That's how I get you guys to come back next week.